voice.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for The Backside of Water, a podcast that delves into the rich history, awesome stories, and fascinating details behind your favorite Disney attractions. I'm Annie Rugit.
And I'm Annie Rugit. I mean, I'm Alex Stewart.
No, you're not. Al.
I almost pulled the fastest ones of the fast ones right there. Sorry. Sorry.
So I'm sneaky.
I'm feeling just giddy tonight because I'm really excited for this episode, because on this episode, we're going to be exploring the magical world of Dumbo, the flying elephant attraction.
And as one of the more truly iconic attractions in the park, exploring the awesome story behind this attraction is sure to be more exciting than a three-ring circus.
Oh, you said it, Andrea. So what are we waiting for? Let's go ahead and get this show on the road. The story of Dumbo the Flying Elephant starts like it does with most attractions in Fantasyland, with an animated film. Walt Disney found inspiration for the studio's fourth animated film in a very unlikely place, though. Dumbo was originally written as a children's story presented in something called a roll-a-book.
A roll-a-book? So, like, what is a roll-a-book? Can you explain this?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Honestly, the details on exactly what a roll-a-book is are a little bit hazy. From what I gather, a roll-a-book was essentially a comic strip in scroll form that was housed inside of the body of a book. There were around a dozen drawings on the roll, accompanied by a few lines of text, and as you would turn the wheels, the pictures would appear as if on a strip of film.
Sounds dandy. I like it. I should try my hand at creating one of these. Ooh. It'd be fun. Now, Dumbo the Sweet Elephant, so unfortunately named, was the star of this book, right?
Yes.
Okay, and it was written by Helen Aberson and Harold Pearl, I've heard. It was published in 1939 with a similar storyline as Disney's film. The sweet little elephant Dumbo is mocked for his floppy ears, but little do they know he can fly.
Now, soon after the book was published, Disney's head of merchandise, a person named Kay Kamen, showed the prototype to Disney, and they purchased the rights as a result. It was a perfect choice for the studio. It would come right after the production of Pinocchio, which was a slightly darker story, and it also came after Fantasia, which lost the studio money in the long run, even though today it's considered a masterpiece. If you want to learn more about Fantasyland, listen to this podcast. But if you want to learn more about Fantasia, jump over to our sister podcast, Did You Know Disney, where my good buddy Dave Nelms and myself are slowly but surely tracking the history of Fantasia. It's going to be a three-part conversation that we have over there. So jump on over, and at the recording of this episode, you can hear part one. And a little teaser, we will be releasing part two, probably in conjunction with this episode. So listen to part one and part two. So historically, it's important to understand that at this time in history, there was also the infamous Disney studio strike during production, which we will talk about in future episodes, no doubt about it. And World War II was also in full force. Both of these factors influenced the projects the studio was taking on at this time. And honestly, budget was one of the biggest influencers in making the decision around feature films at this time.
Very true. The interesting thing, though, is that Dumbo was originally intended to be a short film, but Disney felt that the only way to do this beloved story justice was to give it the time it deserved. But only 64 minutes. So this is actually the shortest feature in Disney history.
It is incredible, because when you watch the movie, when it ends, you're like, oh, wait, that's where it ended. Interesting, because
yeah.
It does seem 64 minutes long. It doesn't seem long at all.
No, it's not. And a lot of the other films are 120 minutes. Not that long. Sorry, an hour and 20 minutes, whatever that is, 80
yes.
minutes long.
Yeah.
So this one, yeah, it feels short. But if you think about it, it is as long, like it's long enough to be a feature, and it has a full, you know, depth of storyline.
I think it's interesting because, I mean, they were able to stretch a picture book story that was only a few slides long into 64 minutes of movie time. So I think that because of that, it's actually pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. Dick Humor and Joe Grant worked on writing the script. And as I said, they initially were going for a short film. They wrote it in chapters and eventually built it up chapter by chapter to be a longer feature.
Now, this isn't how people usually write a script, right? Chapter by chapter, that sounds more like a novel.
No, actually, in this instance, you're correct. It helped the writers develop characters and plot kind of like you would in a novel, rather than trying to pay attention to staying within a time frame like writers usually do when they're working on a script.
Now, I've noticed that Dumbo is a simpler film in a lot of ways. I think some might say that it's a perfect example of conservative filmmaking, one might say.
Very keen eye, Al. So can you elaborate on this?
I'd be happy to, Andrea. Mm-hmm. Settle in. Here we go. In contrast to Fantasia, Snow White, and Pinocchio, the character designs and backgrounds are much cleaner and more simplified. To put it as simple as possible, it's more cartoonish in a nutshell.
You're right. But Disney, being so detail-oriented, still had all the artists use real-life animal references. Their process wasn't simplified, just their execution. It's a brilliant tactic because storytelling and character design, whether simple or descript, is what makes for that Disney magic that we all have come to love, don't you think?
I absolutely agree. And to be completely transparent, Annie, I've cried at more Disney films than any other film I can think of.
But you only watch Disney films, Al. So, you know, and you cry at everything.
And? Andrea, I am a sensitive soul, and I can't help that. And to be fair, to be very fair in this conversation, The Aristocats is a heartbreaking piece of cinema. Be strong.
Al, stop thinking about it. We'll only open the floodgates.
Annie, everybody wants to be a cat.
Al!
Do you understand the power of that? We're all cats. Why are you laughing at this? This is one of the greatest cinematic metaphors in history.
I'm laughing with joy because you're right. I just had an epiphany. Everyone wants to be cats. Thank you, Al. Thank you.
So anyway, you know what? I don't even know what Miley Cyrus says about the haters in that song. I was going to reference a Miley Cyrus song. But anyway.
You could reference Taylor Swift.
Haters going to hate. I'm just going to shake it off.
What a poignant quote.
You know, I use that. That's my bio.
Just repeat the last word 8 times and it's a song.
Thanks, Tay.
Lover's going to love.
So anyway, Dumbo used watercolor for their background art, which also cut time and cost. And Annie, you are primarily using watercolor for your art. Is that not correct?
Yes, because I'm always trying to cut time and cost.
Perfect. Perfect. Makes sense. You are cheap. I'm just...
I am.
I'm just kidding.
I'm definitely cheap. If anyone wants to hire an illustrator, you got a cheap one right here.
And that's why you know that she's going to cut time and costs on your project. I'm kidding, folks. Annie is a great artist. If you ever want to hire her.
And cut quality.
But that's the weird thing is when we looked into this, I always was under the impression, because I know some other friends who are watercolor artists, and I've heard that watercolor is one of the most difficult forms of painting because you actually have to be very controlled with the watercolors because they kind of do their own thing. Is that right?
Yeah, you have to know how the medium works. I always like to think of it as you can't control the medium, but you just have to know like how to let go of control correctly.
Interesting.
It's hard. Yeah, it's a difficult medium, but it's really fun. And it's actually brilliant that Disney decided to kind of, you know, use these techniques to really like cut some of the costs because they're still beautiful, but they did make a big difference in price.
Just because watercolor is cheaper itself, like the watercolor paint or whatever you call it?
It's literally less medium that you need because you're using water and a little bit of pigment, whereas with acrylic or oil paints, you are using a lot more volume of medium, and it's more expensive.
See?
Especially when you're painting thousands of cells.
This is why people decided to join us on the backside of canvas like this. They want to know all about these things. I think that's fascinating. I think that's amazing because you don't really think about literally cutting cost on the materials themselves. I mean, because how many cells are they painting with this stuff? I mean, backgrounds is what they... Is that what they primarily used watercolor for, was the backgrounds of each one of the scenes?
Yes. Yes, they still had to use an opaque paint on the foreground, like the characters. Because that way they could move in front of these backgrounds.
See?
But yeah, all the backgrounds were watercolors, and you'll notice too that they used more stills. So rather than having these backgrounds move or using like a lot of different cuts to different scenes, they kind of simplified everything. But I don't know, Al, like, did you notice that when watching the film? Did you feel like it was really like solid or still?
I honestly think that unless somebody trains their eye to look for those things specifically, I don't think that you would notice whatsoever. I don't think that it just detracts from the piece itself, because I didn't notice it. And in my opinion, I think in some ways less is more with that. And you're able to focus in primarily on the story that is going on in the foreground than being distracted by what's going on in the background.
Yeah, I agree.
And so, one of the things that I think is very cool is that there were other notable Disney films that did use watercolor, such as Snow White and some of the other Disney shorts.
Ow. Ow. Wait, what is that?
Oh, sorry, I'm just practicing.
Practicing for what? Is someone in the room with you?
No, Anne. Actually, I'm practicing my sound effects skills so I can work on feature films.
Oh, okay. Like, you mean how they did for Dumbo?
Of course. Why else would I be doing this right now? I'm a budding nerd, Annie, or a nostalgic effects recording director. I'm starting my own business.
Wow, Al. Okay, you'll inspire all the nerds out there, I'm sure.
Thanks for the support. I'm actually super into systems right now. Believe it or not, Dumbo was recorded conventionally using the RCA system. And one voice was even synthesized using the Sonovox system. And what amazes me is that you have an entire feature with very little spoken dialogue. In fact, none of the actors on this receive screen credit, much like Snow White or Pinocchio.
So, yeah, that seems odd to me. Why was that?
To be honest, I'm not exactly sure, and this is a point of contention with a lot of Disney historians. Some people are like, well, they didn't get the credit they deserved, so on and so forth. But to be completely honest, I don't know if it was so much like an ego thing that they were like, you guys don't matter. But I think that I have no answer to this. One of the only things that I could think of logically is the fact that voice acting was such a new medium that maybe they didn't even think of it as an art form at that time. And what I would want to look at is across the board, were any other animation companies at this time crediting their actors for using their voices? I mean, today we wrangle in really big actor names like Robin Williams for the Genie or James Earl Jones for the voice of Mufasa. But back in the day, they weren't looking for these A-list actors to lend their voices to these characters. So maybe it was just considered a little bit less of a prestigious position like it is today. But anyway, the actors that worked on the film may not sound familiar, but we've heard their voices before. So a woman named Verna Felton, the matriarch of the elephants, who I believe coins the name Dumbo, was also the fairy godmother in Cinderella and also the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland. Other voice actors in this film include the great Sterling Holloway as Mr. Stork, Cliff Edwards, better known as the voice of Jiminy Cricket, as Jim Crow, and John McLeish, best for narrating the Goofy how-to cartoons, providing the opening narration, which is he's an iconic voice in Disney history.
So I do find that really fascinating. The more that I've done this podcast with you, the more it seems like they have this network or this group of actors that they constantly will use for films and like reuse for additional features as they come out.
Absolutely.
It's kind of cool. It's like a little family.
Yeah, and I think it's
voice acting family.
I think it kind of had to be. I mean, the pool was so small at that time that they knew that they could trust these people, that they were reliable and they could be easily worked with. And I think that honestly, it also comes down to contracts. Usually back in the day, a lot of these actors and actresses would sign contracts with studios and say, okay, we're going to do a 6-picture deal, an 8-picture deal, a 12-picture deal, whatever it may be. And they would have to stick to those contracts. So I think that that's another aspect that we're looking at is contract disputes. Welcome to The Backside of Contracts, a podcast where we explore all the things inside and out of contracts from the 1940s.
It's actually kind of cool. I do like learning about this stuff because that's not as much of a thing anymore. You're right. They had a lot of contracts where it was like, you're going to be doing, I don't know, how a number of films with us.
Oh,
like,
totally.
Like, you will be our guy.
Yeah.
And I mean, man, that's how you got into the movie business.
That's exactly. I mean, think about it. I mean, it was tantamount to being
you get locked in.
Yeah, you were an employee. Nowadays,
yeah.
Nowadays, the way we look at it is we've got these independent actors and actresses who are going from studio to studio, and you still actually have, believe it or not, you do have contracts that actors sign, but big name actors, people like Dwayne Johnson or I don't know, Anne Hathaway. They are not going to have contracts with studios, but a lot of them could potentially have had them when they first got into the business simply because, one, there's some security in it, and two, the studio says, okay, well, if this actor like Kevin Hart is going to explode, then we're going to be the ones who are reaping the benefits because he's required to make money for our studio and make films for our studio. So that in that capacity makes sense for both people.
Yeah, it does. It does.
So we digress completely on that one.
There you go, folks. We got a little few extra tidbits this podcast.
A lot of did you knows.
Yeah. So now that we have a baseline of information on the history of the animated film, it's important to talk about some context. We covered a little context earlier, but I think we need to dive in a little further for a better understanding about the world in which Dumbo was released.
That's a great idea. I think that it's important to remember that World War II was raging at this point, and the U.S. was fully invested. Now, because of this, film revenue across the board was just straight in the toilet.
Yeah, can you maybe explain why it was that for those who may not be familiar with all the factors involved during wartime?
Yeah, I'm absolutely happy to do that. So, as Annie just said, there were a few factors causing the number of theatergoers to drop during this era. Firstly, the sheer number of men fighting in the war caused the numbers to drop because they were overseas, well, fighting. Now, secondly, this also meant that the guys weren't taking their dolls out on swanky dates to the movies, so no more, you know, whatever. The numbers dropped because of that factor as well. Now, thirdly, those who weren't busy fighting were devoting most of their time to furthering the war effort, either through hard work, awareness, or honestly worrying that invasion could happen at any moment. These issues were primarily present in the U.S., but globally, all of the previous factors were absolutely huge. So in Europe, you also had things like regular invasions, bombings, air raids, sieges, and a whole platoon full of other things that dissuaded the general population from going to the movies or even wanting to go to the movies.
Yeah, needless to say, this wasn't a good time to be in the movie business.
Well, yes. Well, and no in some ways. I mean, Hollywood studios also did their parts to support the troops during the war by making propaganda films to bolster the public's opinion and the army's spirits during such a dark time. And Disney was one of the studios leading the charge in that effort. Now, on our sister show, Did You Know Disney, we will soon discuss what the Disney studio looked like during this era once the U.S. military took up residence on the studio lot.
Wait, what?
Yes, it will actually be a pretty awesomely historic episode.
So the war caused Dumbo to be a disaster, I'm assuming, right?
Well, one would think so, considering the climate in the world at that time. But believe it or not, Dumbo was one of the most successful films that the studio would release in the 1940s. So to put it into perspective, the film cost $950,000 in 1940s money, which adjusted for inflation today would cost around $15 to $16 million, which really is, even for today's standards, nothing to make a movie. And even at that time, it was dirt cheap. Dumbo cost half of what Snow White did and one third of that of Pinocchio. And don't even get me started on how much less it cost than Fantasia. Again, if you want to know the cost, check out our episodes on Did You Know Disney, because Fantasia was insanely expensive. But yes, Dumbo was way, 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 way less than Fantasia in the cost department.
Okay. So Dumbo would go on to make $1.6 million in 1940s money, which equals to around $26, $27 million today. So that's not too bad, but still not great. It is interesting to note, though, that Dumbo and Snow White were the only two Disney feature films to turn a profit before things started to pick up again in 1943, which is amazing because Disney was, they had such a reputation for being a hit machine at this point.
Absolutely. And, I mean, even today, they have this reputation of being a hit machine. But back then, before the solidification of Disney's iconic filmmaking, It was still touch and go. I mean, it's weird to think that the powerhouse that we know of Disney was once one film away from financial ruin. But to me, it's kind of cool to put that into context like that. It really shows how much of a scrappy little animation studio Disney really did start out as.
Yeah, it's true. Reviews of the film were largely positive. And in fact, Time magazine approached Walt and asked if they could make Dumbo their Mammal of the Year.
Mammal of the Year. I get it. That was a play off of their tradition of the Man or Person of the Year editions, right?
Oh, that makes sense. I thought maybe Time magazine just had a Mammal of the Year every year.
No, it was. I don't think that's regular. This year, it's going to be the Sloth.
I was like, why haven't I heard of this before? Got it.
Where do I vote for the capybara?
If we had to choose a mammal of the year this year, what would it be? Is there any famous animal? Like a celebrity status mammal?
That's a good question. What mammals today hold the same status as Dumbo back in the day? I mean, 2019 is that the recording of this episode, folks. Guess what? Dumbo's coming out this month, y'all. We could have Dumbo as mammal of the year.
Let's do it. That sounds like that's never been done before. Let's do it.
I have to say, I love the innocence of this, though, too, that, I mean, here you look at this time frame, and Time magazine is putting Dumbo as the mammal of the year. That would never happen in the climate that we're living in today. People would be like, are you serious? That's the cheesiest thing ever. But
yeah.
But back in the 1940s, everybody was like, that's great. That's wonderful. Except for what actually took place. Annie, do you want to tell us what actually took the cover of Time magazine?
Yeah. The story gets a little sad because this little fun and playful cover was never fully realized, as the bombing of Pearl Harbor would take center stage instead.
It's amazing because it really does sound surreal. We sit in history class and hear about all these dates that have lived in infamy, but we never really think about how life went on around the world and also how these major world events affected the people and the culture at the time that Dumbo would get kicked out because of the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's so easy to compartmentalize these historical events and forget that, of course, something had to be taken off the cover of Time to be replaced by the bombing of Pearl Harbor. You know, we would have just never thought that it was going to be Dumbo as Mammal of the Year.
It's so true. But it's good to note that Dumbo still made it into Time magazine. It just didn't make the front cover, which seems like a fitting metaphor for the world at this time. Everything took the back page to the war effort, and I kind of think rightfully so.
Yeah, very poignant, Al, very poignant.
Thank you.
But this obviously wasn't Dumbo's last hurrah. Dumbo would go on to re-release the film in theaters in 1949, 1959, 1972, and 1976.
Now, again, for context, it may be important to explain why this was done, especially for some of our younger listeners.
Yeah, great idea. So I thought instead of me explaining why Disney would do this, it would be good to hear from someone who experienced these re-releases firsthand, my great Aunt Zelda. So she lives at the Shady Glen Convalescent Garden. Let's give her a call real quickly, okay?
Hello?
Yeah, this is Alex and Annie from the Backside of Water podcast.
Is that you, Mary Beth?
No, this is Alex and Annie from the Backside of Water podcast. We're wondering if you can answer some questions for us about Dumbo.
What did you want to know about the film?
Well, it wasn't so much about the movie itself, but more about the time period. If you can just explain to our listeners why they would re-release movies over and over, like they used to?
Why, certainly. Well, back in my day, there wasn't such a thing as a television. The only thing we had in the house to entertain us was a big pile of twigs that we picked up from the twig garden out back. We had a twig garden because all the water was being used up by the glue factory to make rubber hoses. Anyway, because there was no television, the movie houses were our only source of entertainment, outside of a good game of poison the waterhole. We would go see the movie time and time again. In fact, that's where your great uncle Melvin first put his arm around me. Talk about a little devil.
Okay, that's a little too much information. Sorry, Aunt Zelda. Okay.
Your Uncle Melvin had the strongest hands.
So anyway, all right. The lack of televisions explains why they released the film in the 40s and 50s. But what about the later releases, Aunt Zelda? Like in the 70s, people had plenty of access to television, right?
Well, of course they did, dear. Why, I remember your great Uncle Melvin came home with a 27-inch Zenith home television in 1960. And boy, were we the talk of the block, if you catch my meaning.
So then, why the re-releases?
Well, even though we had television, that didn't mean they were playing movies on the old TV box all the time. At least not like movies from that rascal Walter Disney.
So they re-released these movies in theaters so people would become more familiar with them, you're saying?
And so we could share them with our little ones, you see. Back in the day, once a movie was out of the theater houses, it was gone for good. So when Wally and his gang would release a film back into theaters, we would travel in droves to the local Cineplex to relive those wonderful experiences we once had in the theater. Oh, over and over again. On top of that, every time they released a movie, we would have a new child, niece or nephew, to take out to the movies. Come to think of it, I think I've paid to see Dumbo about 62 times now with all the releases and children we've been piling up with.
Whoa, 62 times!
In fact, we saw it so many times that we used to just take the kids and put them in the front row, and your great Uncle Melvin and I would find some secluded seats in the back of the theater and cuddle up like there was no tomorrow.
Okay, Zelda, thank you so much for taking this time to explain to us about why they released the movie the way they did.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Mary Beth. Now I'm off to get to the rest of these oyster crackers to get them out of my hair. Martha Cohen got a little crazy with her corn chowder during lunch today, I do declare. Goodbye. You tell your mother goodbye for me too, Mary Beth.
Okay, I'll... Okay, Aunt Zelda, love you.
Wow, she was quite the lady.
Oh, you don't know the half of it, Al.
Well, but I guess on the bright side, she did provide us with some great understanding about the context of why they kept re-releasing these classic Disney films over and over.
It's amazing because to this day, Dumbo still holds a 97% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And back in 2011, Time magazine claimed that Dumbo was one of the 25 all-time best animated films.
Now, there definitely is no doubt that Dumbo is an animated classic that has stood the test of time. It also makes it apparent why Walt chose to add Dumbo to his park's lineup of attractions.
Al, let's get into it, shall we? You want to go for a ride?
Oh, and how?
Please exit to your right-hand side, folks. Have a magical day here at Walt Disney's Disneyland.
Gosh, Dumbo gets me every time. My heart. Can you hear it, Al? What a rush.
Finally, somebody else gets it. It feels like riding high on Dumbo's back around Fantasyland, looking over the poor people waiting in line below.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, Al. You ride on Dumbo's back and you look All right. So when the Disney Imagineers were developing the ride, you didn't get to ride on your very own Dumbo, as cute as he is.
Wait, what? I want my money back.
Well, hey. This is just before. Now you have your own Dumbo.
Okay.
Everything's right with the world.
I'll give you my money again.
Oh, thanks, Al. $5. So, yeah, they thought it would be cool to have everyone in pink bobbing elephants. And there's only one Mickey Mouse, right?
Well, and there's only one Dumbo. I mean, that totally makes sense. I do recall there being a pink pachyderm parade in the film as kind of a sort of nightmare.
Yeah, that's right. But Walt eventually decided against this, saying that he'd rather have everyone riding their own Dumbo, not an alcohol-induced hallucination.
That's funny. Was that actually a quote from Walt Disney? Because I would love if that was a quote from Walt Disney.
I mean, the internet says it is.
That's amazing. Good call, Walt. Okay, so as sort as the Dumbo ride was, so was this bit. Now, back to the studio. Arrow would be responsible for the ride system and lift arms, fabricating and assembling the elephants at the Disney studio about 300 miles away. I think it's 30 miles away. Because Burbank isn't 300 miles from Anaheim. I swear.
My geography is terrible.
I swear we're not reading a script or anything like that. We're just going off the cuff. So a NASA engineer advised the Aero team in using a combination of oil and nitrogen in the hydraulic system for added power, which should have worked, but unfortunately it didn't.
It didn't, yes. Also, just so everyone knows, I'm actually using sign language to cue Al on all of this.
And we're
recording.
So
that's what's happening. We're sitting in front of each other in a room, and I'm signing to him what he's going to say.
She's mouthing it to me.
Okay. So the combination produced foam from the tessellation, and effectively it disabled the lift system. Then there were issues with the elephants. Over in Burbank, they were creating elephants with internal engines to make each ear flap. They were very ambitious. And these sweet little Dumbos ended up weighing 800 pounds.
That's, from my understanding, that's a little bit more than a real baby elephant.
It is. And you should know, because you used to weigh those baby elephants in the Jungle Cruise.
I actually used to be a baby elephant.
Just making sure they weren't gaining weight. Used to be a Every time I try and make a little joke, you just one-up me with something way better.
Don't kid yourself. That wasn't way better. That was a migraine-induced joke, folks. Sorry, bottom of the barrel right now.
I guess I have low taste. Because I loved it. So, yeah, they realized a problem with pairing these monster Dumbos and the San Jose lift system that they were trying to use in Anaheim. With these issues, there seemed to be no possible way that the ride would be up and running by park opening on July 17th, 1955.
Now, even though the attraction wouldn't be ready for opening day, that didn't stop Imagineers from working tirelessly to get Dumbo ready for opening as soon as they could. The first batch of elephants would be delivered to Dumbo's original location, just west of where they currently stand as of recording of this episode.
That's interesting. They used to be located somewhere other than they are now, right?
Yes, indeed. Originally, the attraction was placed on the western side of Fantasyland, where the food and souvenir vendors are located right below Casey Jr. This would be where Dumbo would take his first flight, but that flight wouldn't happen before a lot of issues were resolved.
That's right. Each elephant on the attraction was designed in such a way that as they flew, their ears would flap up and down. But the mechanisms that caused this flapping were really quite heavy and added even more problems to the already troubled operations of this attraction. So, at the 11th hour, the flapping ears were nixed, and they would go to confuse many guests in the future, as the ears looked like they could flap, but never actually did.
Suckers! So, Aero Development would go on to strip the motors for these flapping ears altogether, making each unit much lighter than when I used to be a baby elephant, and more able to be used for the troubled lift systems to, lift them. The test and adjust period, the time where they continue to test the ride and see how it works and make any necessary adjustments, went on for many days. It wasn't until early August of 1955 that Aero had come up with a solution to this problem. Well, actually, it was a two-part solution. The first part was able to be implemented due to the fact that the elephants had become lighter due to the removal of the ear engines. Now that the elephants' ears were lighter, the elephants themselves were lighter, the hydraulic system would be able to actually lift them off the ground, but the foaming around the lift cylinders was still a major issue. To solve this problem, Dumbo was outfitted with a team of milkers.
Milkers? I don't like that.
That's right. Well, you wouldn't like this attraction then, because the attraction would foam up so often that a team of engineers had to be devoted to the removal of the cylinder foam. These engineers begin joking that they were hired to milk Dumbo, which is moving on. This removal of the foam had to happen multiple times during the day, sometimes even as frequently as between every single ride cycle.
Oh my gosh, that is a full-time milking job.
It really was. But it allowed the attraction to finally be open to park guests. And on August 16th, 1955, almost a full month after the park had opened, Dumbo the Flying Elephant would take his first guests on a magical flight through the skies over Fantasyland.
Dumbo would continue to be milked, but over time, it just became too much of a hassle, obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously. I don't know why they even put up with it in the first place.
Too much Dumbo milk.
I can just imagine an ad. We need new milkers for the Dumbo ride.
Are you tired? Are you languid? Do you have trouble with your joints? Well, try Dumbo milk.
The process was just sloppy, and they just didn't work well for a good guest experience, obviously. Again, I don't know why they put up with this for so long. So instead, Walt met with the Aero team to come up with a more effective long-term solution. This solution would be much more costly than hiring milkers, though. Walt chose to have the Aero team completely redesign and build an entirely new lift system, which makes sense why he put this off. This system would be designed to better accommodate the weight of the paunchy pachyderms and the constant wear and tear associated with such a popular attraction.
Within a few months of the attraction's opening, Aero had assembled and installed the new lift system. With this new installation came much more ornate theming as well. The trim work on the new lift system looked much less dumpy and more Dumbo. Another piece of flourish would show up as well with the new lift system, a wonderful little likeness of our second favorite rodent, Timothy Mouse. Timothy would stand high on top of it all, watching down on the happy guests enjoying a flight with Dumbo. The figure was sculpted by animator, sculptor, and Disney legend Blaine Gibson. For those not familiar with the sculpting process, myself included, it's common knowledge among sculptors that after a piece is constructed out of simple clay, it must be wrapped in plastic in a certain way to prevent it from dehydrating. Well, Gibson went to unwrap his Timothy Mouse figure that stood atop the tall Dumbo attraction, only to find that somebody had unwrapped it to take a peek at it. Unfortunately, they had unwrapped it too early and the figure had cracked from the dehydration. Thankfully, Gibson, being a genius and great artisan, was able to perform a quick repair on the figure, so nothing was permanently ruined. This is cool, though, because it wasn't until later found that the culprit was discovered. It was Walt Disney himself. In his excitement, he had gone up and unwrapped it to take a peek, but didn't wrap it back up. Gibson was a good sport about it, though, and the rest is history.
Well, he had to be a good sport about it, right? It was Disney.
Very good point.
You don't cross Disney. That's really kind of sweet, though, that he was excited and wanted to go take a peek.
Yeah, just take a little gander.
Yeah. So did you know, Al, that President Harry Truman visited Disneyland in 1957 and did not ride Dumbo? The nerve.
Well, he was a pretty superstitious guy, right?
Yeah. Okay, who wouldn't love the adrenal fire that is incited by this ride? I mean, come on. I can remember the pure blissful dizziness.
I think one of my favorite phrases in the history of the human language is adrenal fire.
Thank you. I wrote it myself.
You've got to be really sensitive if Dumbo gets you dizzy. No wonder you hate the Mad Tea Party. Wait, so Truman didn't want to ride Dumbo only because he didn't want to be seen on an attraction that could possibly be associated with the Republican Party.
Yeah, so you already know this. I thought that was a really interesting fact.
I agree. I think it's hilarious.
Yeah. And in May 1983, at the opening of New Fantasyland, the Dumbo had to move where Skull Rock Lagoon had been. They updated the attraction, Still, we see 10 elephants at this time, but during this reconstruction, they designed it to look like it does today. The biggest change to the Dumbo ride came in 1990 after two accidents.
Well, it was March 29th of 1989 when a Garden Grove couple and their three-year-old daughter were riding along in their own Dumbo car. The fiberglass elephant suddenly split, part of it separating from a support arm. The family suffered bruises and scrapes, but thankfully nothing more, and Dumbo reopened the next day.
A year later, on April 1st, 1990, a 13-year-old girl from Canada was happily soaring over Dumbo. In her glee, she was jostled around, and another supporting arm collapsed. She suffered bruises, but no more.
The accidents were minor, but definitely concerning. Disneyland obviously needed a safe Dumbo attraction, so they closed it and tried to figure out next steps. Imagineers had a 16-elephant version ready for Euro Disneyland, but the park wasn't due to open until 1992. So that version went over to Anaheim. With 60% more capacity, the engineers still had plenty of time to make another for Disneyland Paris, and the perfect update they needed for the original ride was given to Disneyland.
Yeah, and this was the redesign that they started back, like, closer to 1983.
Okay.
Was the 16-elephant version. So they had it all ready to go once these accidents were kind of concerning them. So can you tell us how this ride works?
So there's 16 ride vehicles, all in the shape of Dumbo, of course, and they're mounted on articulated armatures connected to a rotating hub. You can move your elephant up and down via a joystick that operates a hydraulic ram. All these technical terms that I have no idea what they mean, but it's all true. It's all fact. The ride rotates counterclockwise at a constant rate. In fact, all the Dumbo rides do except for the newer Dumbo in Walt Disney World.
And a teeny Timothy Q. Mouse, currently voiced by Chris Edgerly, rides atop the central hub on these Dumbo rides. Originally, he held a whip and stood on a disco ball, which sounds amazing.
Yes. Yes, it does.
And with the exception of Tokyo Disney, he now stands atop a balloon and holds the magic feather.
In Tokyo, whips and disco balls are offensive. No, I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of a funny little tweak.
I think, actually, in Tokyo, they still have the disco ball.
Oh, just...
It's with the exception of Tokyo... he's now, like all the other parks, he's on a balloon and holds the magic feather.
What's my name? Why am I tasting almonds right now? I need to lay down.
Do you smell toast? Do you smell toast?
I do. It's funny. The other day I was walking through my school halls and I was like, it smells like toast in here. And I made a joke about that and nobody got it. I was like, don't you smell toast right before you go down with the big one?
Yeah, you do.
Okay. So,
which sucks, because I like the smell of toast. But going down with the big one will be something to look forward to.
I guess so. It's a little less disco and a little more Disney going on around here without that disco ball around.
Yeah, agreed. Although Timothy cut a mean rug in his days, you know? I miss those disco days.
Amen.
So Dumbo the Flying Elephant is an attraction that completes the Disneyland landscape. Though it narrowly missed the opening day festivities, it is still one of the core attractions that has helped build the reputation of Disneyland from the very start. It is a simple attraction that reminds its riders that it is the simple things that endure, and that is what makes the attraction so unforgettable and so lovely.
And that is the story of the ups and downs and ups of Dumbo the Flying Elephant. Folks, if you like this episode of The Backside of Water, we would love if you'd take a few minutes to write us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to hear more about the full story of Disneyland, please subscribe to our show to get all of that. Oh, everybody loves to find all of our reviews on all of our shows posted on Apple. That's got to be a website. Also, if you want to hear more about the full story of Disneyland, please subscribe to the show and start at episode 1.
You can also join the ever-growing Backside of Water community by following us on Instagram and joining our Facebook group as well.
You can also check out our sister podcast, Did You Know Disney, a podcast where we take what we do on this show and expand it out to any and every topic within the wonderful world of Disney. Before we end here, I also want to give a quick shout out to one of our listeners by the name of Wesley. When Annie and I were in the park just a few weeks ago together doing some research, Wesley came over and found us while we were in the tropical hideaway and professed that he enjoyed the show. He's a 7-year-old kid, and we just wanted to say thanks, Wesley, for listening. We love having listeners just like you.
So until next time, as you exit, please watch your head and watch your step.
And if you happen to miss your step and hit your head, please watch your language. Goodbye.